Good evening. This is Travis Shaddix. So glad you could join us this evening. This is Turfgrass Epistemology. I'm sorry, something just struck my funny right before I hit the play button. I hope everybody's doing well. This is Turfgrass Epistemology. How do we know what we know about turfgrass science? That's why you're here. That's why I'm here, constantly learning. See, the chat is already filled up. Harper Explorers, good evening. Gray Fox, Looney, Andrew Burris, Brady, Chuck, Ground Up Organic, and Lawn Dingo. I like the chat, so welcome all. This is Mental Health Awareness Month, and we're going to be talking about mental health the entire month. Psychology, not so much mental health as it is the topic of psychology. And I am not a psychologist. I've never taken a class in it. I guess I've gone to some seminars, I suppose. But I'm not even an amateur psychologist. I'm a patient. that's my level of interaction with the world of psychology. So I do think it's important to at least acknowledge this month that mental health is important. And so I'm going to go over it the entire month, or I'm going to use psychology this entire month. Remind people that this is mental health awareness. Remind people that we have loved ones. We have members of our community who don't seek help, you know, and not even seek help. It's not like you need help. It's just don't exercise your mind and, you know, work on your mental health. I hesitate to even say seek help because it almost implies there's a weakness or something. But, you know, I certainly encourage you to pursue your mental health just like you might pursue your physical health. And there's really no difference, really, in my mind. And, by the way, before I start the whole month, don't take anything I say as fact. I'm not a psychologist, okay? Just take what I'm saying. Think about your own world. Think about your own life. Perhaps your mother or your son or your daughter or your grandpa or your employer or your subordinates, your employees, and see how these things sort of relate, and try to pull something useful out of it. But I'm going to be wrong. I'm wrong on the topics that I'm knowledgeable on, soil science. Okay. So I'm definitely going to be wrong on psychology. But that's not the intent. The intent is just to bring awareness to mental health and to encourage people who have been thinking about it, perhaps, to go ahead and do that. I mean, you all who are veterans of the show know that I've been in mental therapy for a long time. The last session I did was about a year long, 2 days a week for about a year. I guess about a year. Things have kind of settled down. I need to start that back up. But there's nothing wrong with it. I think it's a sign of strength to acknowledge that this is something you need to work on and something that can help make you a better person and help make you a more successful businessman, a more successful leader. Find ways in yourself, find weaknesses in yourself that you can work on that will help make you more money by having your employees reach their fullest potential, finding ways to motivate them. At the end of the day, we're in business and we're in business to make money, but there's many ways to go about that. And if your employees are not at their potential, reaching their potential, then you're not at your potential revenue as well. So think of it that way. So just think about it in your own business, your own world, your own marriage, your own relationship, whatever the case is, this whole month. That's what the intent of this entire month is, just to be aware that mental health is important, just like physical health, and don't neglect it. Don't neglect it. So Ground Up Organic says he's amped up about this and been dealing with a lot of frustration, hoping to learn how to deal with it better. Well, you know, I've said this before. Sometimes I swear it seems like I plant people in the chat. Like they say something so specific to what I'm going to go over. I'm like, you know, I didn't plant this person, but that Ground Up Organic really hit a topic on the head. And that is, I'm going to be going over a lot of my own personal career and my own personal anecdotes and stories and my own shortcomings and failures and use those as examples to, you know, magnify the importance of understanding some basics of motivation and needs and what drives people. And if you understand that, it helps me reduce my frustration. I'm going to have a very specific example tonight. I'll go ahead and give you a little teaser now. A very specific example tonight of somebody in the lawn care community who has been criticizing me and in one case lying about me. And it's only through my interest in understanding his motivation and then recognizing what his motivation is likely, what's likely motivating that behavior, that it helps reduce my frustration. It helps reduce the temperature. Because I have knowledge of what's going on, and that knowledge is powerful, right? So instead of going off and, you know, fighting back and saying something, you know, acting like a sixth grader or something and, you know, causing some conflict, it helps me. Oh, that's why he's doing that. I see. Okay. I understand why he's doing that now. No problem. And if I didn't know the sort of some of the reasons, the motivation behind such behavior, I would still be frustrated. So Ground Up Organic, thank you for saying that in the comments. And that's hopefully the intent and sort of a segue or a transition into mental health. You get frustrated, you get angry, and you keep going. You don't know how to de-escalate. You don't know what's causing that. Well, knowing what might be, you know, leading to those sorts of feelings is what has helped me in my career. So, I hope that's what comes across this month. It reminds me, I guess it was yesterday, or she said it many times. I saw my wife just mention something in the chat. She's mentioned this many times where she says, "You have such a soothing voice. I could fall asleep to your voice when I'm listening to your show." And I'm like, I know you're trying to give me a compliment, but I don't know if I want to have a voice that puts my audience to sleep. So, but I know she's trying to give me a compliment. It's just like, I don't know if I want to do that. But some of that's just my personality. Some of that's my old age. Some of it's me working on myself, you know, working on myself for many years, trying to be a better person. So that reminds me, there was somebody who put a note in the chat and said, so many advertisements, so many breaks on one of the videos. And somebody else had mentioned that too. And I looked at it and I think I'm doing everything right. And I looked at that particular video that this gentleman made a comment about. And I found out I finally figured out a way to go in and actually see the breaks that YouTube puts in there. And for a 70-minute video, YouTube put in 26 breaks in a 70-minute video. Because I'm letting YouTube like select the spots where they put the breaks. And I put it on the least amount of advertising. And so anyway, make a long story short, is I think the reason why YouTube put so many breaks in my show is because I generally speak slow and I pause between sentences. And in real life, it's much more than this show. Actually, I speak much slower and lower, and I take these long pauses sometimes. At least I've been accused of that. And I think YouTube recognizes that as a spot to put an advertising in, and they stuck an advertising in 26 times. So I've cut that out, and I've just arbitrarily stuck advertisings in every 30 minutes. So it shouldn't do that anymore. So thank you for the person who was saying that. I think he was trying to be, I don't know if he was being rude or if he was trying to be helpful, but one way or the other, it did help me. And so now I hope I fixed it. So if you're watching YouTube, and if you're watching this on a podcast, you listen to it on podcast, that's different, but on YouTube, it should be minimal now, I hope. Chuck Benzing says his son is wrapping up his master's degree in psychology, and it's a target-rich environment for sure. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'm an advocate for therapy. I mean, if I had my way, everybody in a position of leadership in a state university, it would be compulsory that they would take mental therapy, you know, training or some or something. If you're in a position of leadership over another human being and you're being paid by tax dollars, I would make it compulsory to seek mental therapy, you know, at least once a month. I don't think you could do much with once a month. You really need to go once a week, but still, it's very, very important. Woody865 says, not floor. I think that's in response to my video with someone else was breaking the law. Yeah. It's okay, Lou. She says she meant in a good way. I know you meant in a good way. So, and then Andrew says there's 3 or 4 commercials in the live stream. Okay. Well, now there should only be 1 or 2. I hope. We'll see. So this month we're going over mental health awareness. We're going to be going over 8 or 9 papers. I'm going to do my best to do them justice, even though I'm not a psychologist. I don't know the literature. I don't know anything about psychological literature at all. I can't refer to any of my knowledge on any of that because I don't have any knowledge on it. So if you have any questions, we're going to have to get a psychologist on here. There was a couple of psychologists who contacted me, and I asked them to let's set up a meeting so maybe I can get a psychologist on here. A couple of them have said they're unavailable, but well, there's still 1 or 2 floating out there that might come on this month. So we're going to go over the concept of, we have basically 9 papers, 9 days, 9 sessions. And so we're going to go over a concept called BAID, which is a bias against disconfirming evidence. We're going to go over some of Deepak Chopra's word salad nonsense. We're going to go over the Dunning-Kruger effect. There's an article I'm going to go over with pesticides and depression. I have another article I'm going to go over with migrant workers in the farm and agriculture and their relationship between their housing and depression. And then at the end, the last day of this month is actually going to be on a Tuesday because I have some family obligations towards the end of this month. So the last Thursday of the month is actually going to happen on a Tuesday night instead of a Thursday night. And I'm going to go over my psychological evaluation on that Tuesday night to wrap this whole thing up as a means to really just show people there's really nothing to be scared about. There's nothing to be embarrassed about. And also as a means for me to help me come to terms and to grips with some of the things that have been going on in my personal life and my personal well-being. And so we'll go over that on a Tuesday night, the last Tuesday of May. So that's sort of the setup for the month. Okay. Okay. So today we're going to go over Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Now, if those of you who aren't familiar with Maslow's hierarchy of needs, I'm going to go over a brief one slide PowerPoint, just one slide to kind of introduce you to the topic. And then we're going to have a small little 1 minute audio clip from Dr. Maslow. And then we're going to go over the paper that actually introduced this hierarchy to the world that was published in 1943. So without further ado, let's get going. So if you're not familiar with Maslow's, Maslow's hierarchy of needs is a manner in which we can categorize in prepotent order various human needs, and where you're at on that scale or the hierarchy will often be the factor that's motivating you. And the factor that's motivating your employer might be different or might be the same. The factor that's motivating your employees might be the same as yours. It might be different. And understanding where they're at on that hierarchy will help you understand as an employer. I should say me. It helped me understand when I was leading the sales team or when I was in charge of students or whatever the case was. It helped me once I realized this hierarchy can help me understand what's motivating this person or what can motivate this person to reach their potential. Once I realized that, I started speaking and leading in a much more precise and defined way with each individual, because everybody is an individual and they have different needs. They may be on a different level than other people. So the hierarchy starts like this. At the bottom is the physiological needs of humans. And bottom doesn't mean like if you're here, you're a better person or you're a worse person or anything like that. That's not what that means at all. What it means is that once your needs are met, well, let's say all your needs are completely met and then they're removed, people will revert to the most fundamental physiological needs first and get those met. And these physiological needs are things like water, like food, like intercourse, like sleep, these fundamental needs. Think of it as like, let's say you're a new student and you're going to move to Stillwater, Oklahoma, and you don't have any, all your stuff's in your car and you're driving straight to Stillwater. One of the first things you're going to need to do when you get there is find some food and some water. You've probably been driving for 4 or 5 hours and you're probably hungry, right? So think of it like that is a fundamental physiological need that must be met before you can move to the next level. And I know I'm not a psychologist, but there is some, even in Dr. Maslow's 43 paper, he mentions, there is some movement between categories or hierarchies. So you might only have 90% of your physiological needs met and you might already be moving to the next level and so forth. You don't necessarily have to have 100% met before you actually go to the next level, but what is motivating you at whatever stage you're at will be identified by where you're at on the hierarchy, okay? So physiological. So for example, how would this be useful in business? If you're trying to motivate your employees, and I'm going to use my own examples here for a couple times. If you're trying to motivate your employees by saying, you know, I like what you're doing. Let's just say, Bob, I like what you're doing, Bob. I think you're good at what you're doing. And I want to help you. I want to send you to a conference so that you can become better. You can understand more knowledge, or you have more knowledge and you can become better at what you're doing. That might motivate some people, but if they're physiological needs haven't been met, they're working on the physiological level. They need water. They need food. They need sleep. That's what's motivating them. They don't care about going to some conference to get better at what they're doing, because when they leave work, they don't have any food. That's what motivates them, is on that physiological level. So from a business perspective, that's sort of how to look at it, okay? When we go to the next level up the hierarchy, which didn't work, here we go. Come on, is safety. So after you have your basic physiological needs met, the next need is safety. These are things like money, like having a house, like having protection, you know, protection from fire and all these things. So again, imagine you're going to, you know, Gainesville, Florida, and you drove all the way there and you pull off and you pull off at McDonald's or wherever, and you're so hungry and you eat. I go, okay, all right, I got something to eat. Now you're thinking, okay, I got to have some place to stay. I need a house. I need an apartment. I need to stay with somebody. That's the next need you would have. You wouldn't be thinking, oh, I need to go to the library and become more knowledgeable on, you know, soil testing, Malic 3 phosphorus. You wouldn't be thinking that stuff. You'd be thinking, I need a place to sleep. I need a place to stay. I need to get a money. I need to have a house, you know. So that's the next safety need. That's the way to kind of look at that. That's the way I look at it, I should say. The next need after safety is met is, this isn't working today, is loving and belonging. So this would be things like the feeling or the need to be a part of your business, or be a part of a loving relationship, or be a part of a family, or be a part of a team. To belong, that need would be the next need met on the hierarchy. The next need that would arise after the physiological and safety needs have been met, the next need would be loving and belonging. So those would be things like, so it'd be love, but not like sexual intercourse love. It'd be like intimacy love. So the physiological need to reproduce is at the bottom. You physically need to reproduce as a human, but the need to feel love as a human is in the third level, okay? And the need to feel belonging to a marriage, or belonging to whatever, you know, group that you want to be, you know, feel belonging to. It might be your church, or it might be something else, but that need to feel a part of something is in the category of the third level, the hierarchy. The next level is self-esteem. So self-esteem are things like the need to feel like you're accepted by your peers, or you're scoring high on a grade or on a test, and other people see you as smart or intelligent, or you perceive yourself as being intelligent or smart. So that self-esteem, that desire to be seen as whatever it is you want to be seen as. You want to be seen by your peers as being a good artist or a good, you know, piano player or a good scientist or whatever, a good publisher. You want to be seen by your friends as being a good poker player, whatever. That level, that level is deemed the self-esteem level. And I'm going to come to that later on tonight as a specific example. Okay. And then the top is self-actualization. So self-actualization, think of self-actualization as the need to reach your fullest potential. So if you're a, if you are a business owner, you might be at any level of this hierarchy, but a self-actualization would be like a business that's been around probably for quite a long time, is very healthy, has plenty of money. They have nothing to worry about in terms of their buildings and their production and their revenue. They have everything going and they realize, how can I reach my fullest potential? How can the business reach its fullest potential? It's probably by having our employees reach their fullest potential. It's probably by donating and contributing to the community so the community can reach their fullest potential. That's an example of how a business might be at the level of self-actualization, whereas some businesses, when they first start off, are at the level of physiological. You need, you know, customers, and then you go to safety. You need money. You need a building. You need equipment, you know, these sorts of things. And then when you get to belonging, you need to feel a part of the lawn care community or the golf course community and so forth. That's kind of how it works, whether it's in a business or in a personal setting. That's the way, this is my perception of how to interpret this. Okay, so this is the fundamentals of the Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Okay, it's been presented in many different ways. Some things online, you'll see each one of these categories further separated out, further exemplified, and they have different examples within each level to, I guess, help you better understand it. But when you want to ask yourself, how do I motivate my employee? And the reason you want to motivate your employee, I'm assuming, is because you want to make more money. Even if it is your interest for them to reach their potential, it is in some ways selfish on our part because we want them to reach their potential because we want our company to reach its greatest potential, and that is making more money, seeing more customers, developing stronger relationships, whatever the case is. But recognizing where your employees are and where you are on this hierarchy has, well, I should say for me, has really helped me be able to better understand why people are behaving in a certain way. And that knowledge has helped my own mental well-being, just knowing, oh, okay, that's why they said that, or that's why they're behaving that way, because they're not motivated by self-actualization at this point. They're not interested in, you know, having accolades and self-esteem and having prizes. They're not interested in that. They're interested in having a house. That's what's motivating them, or whatever the case is. They're interested in money, whatever the case is. And anything above that might at some point in their life motivate them, but not right now. Okay. So that's the way I've used it over the years. It's been very helpful. In fact, it was very helpful literally just last night. And I'll get into that a little bit later. Okay. So now let's go to what I want to do now is I want to go to Dr. Maslow. I want to go to a short little video of Dr. Maslow. And I want to show in this video, now around this time in 1950-ish, 1940s and 50s, this concept of humanism started to become developed in the psychological community. And Dr. Maslow was right at the forefront of that movement. And since then, there's been, the revolution of humanism really started about that time, probably in the late 60s, early 70s. And in this particular video, he's talking about humanism and he's talking about how the concept or the theory was developed in his mind and how he kind of, you know, how it sort of lingered for a while and so forth. But he has a short clip here, about 1 minute, that I'm going to show where he's discussing, a little bit about how it has benefited him to understand how, hang on a second. Something popped up here on YouTube. Okay, to understand more about it, it has helped him as a person, and he kind of explains it. I'm not doing it justice. Let me just play it, and it's just 1 minute long. This one I'm not going to interrupt Dr. Maslow. I'm going to let it play. Make sure it's playing.
It's what it amounted to for me was learning to see through the eyes of lofty people. So I learned slowly to see things the way they did, to understand what motivated them, to understand what they valued and what they didn't value. And to perceive the motivations, the emotions, the humor, and this very, very interesting business of the mystical experiences that they reported, to my total surprise. Each of these were texts which I could then pursue in this pioneering research style. You know, it's kind of innovative research.
Okay, so what he's talking about there is actually humanism, but he's talking about, I'm taking from that. He is able to see people and to understand their motivations and empathize with people because he's trying to put himself in their position and looking back and say, what is motivating them? How is my behavior influencing them? How are they seeing my behavior? You know, those sorts of empathetic approaches. And from my perspective, not having any knowledge or formal training in psychology whatsoever. Okay, so I've said it. Let's keep saying it. Understanding Maslow's hierarchy has, in many ways, forced me to put myself in their other person's shoes. What is motivating them? What did I say to have them behave this way? Or what's going on in their world that would result in their behavior? Either it's appropriate or inappropriate behavior, harmful behavior or helpful behavior. What is it that is motivating them? Because if I can understand what's motivating them, then I can speak to them on that level. And it's more likely, in my opinion, that they're going to respond favorably and meet that need that they have. They're doing something, they're behaving some way because they have a need that hasn't been met. That's the way I'm perceiving it. And I want to know what that need is so that I can provide it and help them. Okay. So that's the way I read that video, all right? So now that we've introduced the topic, I'm going to go through the 1943 paper where Dr. Maslow introduced the topic to the world. And I want you to point out, I pulled that, I hope everybody's okay. Something's happening here on my screen with YouTube. I pulled that hierarchy diagram just a couple days ago off of the internet or whatever. I mean, it's new. And I'm going to read this. We're going to read parts of the 1943 paper. And I want you to notice how almost nothing has changed. He published this, you know, whatever it's 80 years ago, 70 years ago. And it holds true today just as much as it did in 1943. Now, there have been some adjustments. There's been some fierce criticisms of it, as I'm not that familiar with it, but I'm aware there's been a lot of criticisms of Maslow's approach and the hierarchy of needs, for sure, and the self-actualization definition and the challenges and the inconsistencies in his theory when it comes to some people not ever being self-actualized. I understand there's problems there. But the fundamentals of the hierarchy are there, and it seems to be valuable to the point where people are still using it. I'm still using it. I find it valuable in my own life, and I find it valuable in just helping me to be a better person, help me understand, why is my son behaving that way? Why is my neighbor behaving that way? Good or bad? Doesn't always have to be bad. But, okay, mentally, I'm thinking, where are they at in the hierarchy? Okay, he's talking about, he's in emergency mode because he has this need. Okay, I need to talk to him at that point to address that need. Otherwise, there's no point in having a conversation. He's uninterested in anything above it or below it. He's talking about what's in the middle. Okay. So this is Maslow's paper. It's titled A Theory of Human Motivation by Abraham Maslow in 1943, and it was published in Psychological Review in 1943. If you want to know, like, get an insight into my psychological evaluation. Honestly, how many people in the chat or listening to this right now have ever sat and read an article from 1943? I can't believe there's that many. But for some reason, I can't explain it. I just don't think that I'm neurotypical. I have some my own issues, but I enjoy these papers. 1943, A Theory of Human Motivation. So he has a whole list of like pre-work that was done, and then he kind of introduces this paper. And he says, the present paper is an attempt to formulate a positive theory of motivation, which will satisfy these theoretical demands and at the same time conform to the known facts, clinical and observational, as well as experimental. It derives most directly, however, from clinical experience. So Dr. Maslow was an American psychologist. He was at a number of universities. And most of this comes from his clinical experience working with patients. Okay. Now we go to the next paragraph. It is far easier to perceive and to criticize the aspects in motivation theory than to remedy them. I think he's kind of maybe thinking like some people are going to attack this. And that's easy. It's easy to attack. It's not so easy to come up with a solution. And I agree. You can attack all you want. That's fine. I put stuff out there. You can attack all you want. I write papers. You can attack them all you want. I expect fierce criticism of my work. No problem. Because that fierce criticism is going to make my next paper better. It's going to make the scientific model better. That's what I want. And what he's saying is, you can attack it all you want, but you can't come up with a remedy that's that easy. It's much more difficult to come up with a solution. Mostly this is because of the very serious lack of sound data in this area. I conceive this lack of sound facts to be due primarily to the absence of a valid theory of motivation. This was in 1943. The present theory, then, must be considered to be a suggested program of or framework for future research and must stand or fail not so much on facts available or evidence presented as upon research to be done. Research is suggested, perhaps, by the questions raised in this paper. In other words, he's saying this may live or die, but it shouldn't be live or die upon what's available today, the facts available and the evidence today, but what questions it brings up and whether or not those questions, after sufficient investigation, hold, whether or not the theory holds based upon these new questions. So the first basic of the basic needs, as you saw in the pyramid, is the physiological needs right here. The physiological needs are, as I mentioned, water, food, intercourse, reproduction, these sorts of things must be met by all humans. Well, when I say all humans, and when Dr. Maslow says all humans, what he prefaces by saying neurotypical people, in other words, schizophrenic people, people with psychological conditions that will fall outside of the bell curve, would not necessarily fit into those categories. There's going to be some extremes on both ends that are not typical. And so when he says these must be met, he's talking about the neurotypical person, okay? The physiological needs. And I'm going to skip through here because he has a pretty lengthy introduction to the physiological needs, but he comes back to it right here and he says, undoubtedly, these physiological needs are the most prepotent of all needs. What this means specifically is that in the human being who is missing everything in life in an extreme fashion, it is most likely that the major motivation would be the physiological needs rather than any others. A person who is lacking for food, safety, love, and esteem would most probably hunger for food more strongly than anything else. So what it means is, if you're on that pyramid somewhere, everybody's on the pyramid somewhere, and if the entire pyramid is removed and you have nothing, most likely you're going to revert back to, I need to eat and I need water. That's what's going to motivate you. And then you'll start building yourself back up the pyramid. Okay, that's what he's saying. If all the needs are unsatisfied and the organism is then dominated by the physiological needs, all other needs may become simply non-existent or be pushed into the background. It is then fair to characterize the whole organism by saying simply that it is hungry for consciousness is almost completely preempted by hunger. All capacities are put into the service of hunger satisfaction, and the organization of these capacities is almost entirely determined by the one purpose of satisfying hunger. There's an interesting experiment, of course, that would never do in humans. But there's an interesting experiment, and again, whatever I'm saying, it's almost better to assume I'm wrong because I'm not a psychologist. But my recollection is, if in the presence of food, it is essentially, for a normal person, it's impossible to go on a hunger strike and die from it when there's food in front of you. And the reason for that is that your brain and your body will start shutting off organs in a very specific order. And at some point, it's going to shut off the function in your brain that says, my higher need to prove a point to society, I'm going on a hunger strike because I want the government to recognize that we need to change X. This is so important to me, I'm going to go on a hunger strike. Eventually, your brain and your body is going to start shutting down organs where that part of the brain that's telling you that is so important, it's going to shut down. And the part of your body and brain that says, I need to eat, is going to take over. So in the presence of food, as long as there's food there, it's, from my understanding, it's not possible for you to die. You will eventually eat that food if it's available to you, because your body will literally shut everything down in order to the point where the only thing left is the part of your body that drives you to eat. Okay? I could be wrong. Don't forget, this whole month I could be wrong. For the man who is extremely and dangerously hungry, no other interests exist but food. He dreams food. He remembers food. He thinks about food. He emotes all about food. He perceives only food, and he wants only food. And you can see this in some of the cultures, some of the mythologies around the world. Thousands of years ago, when some of these mythologies were being carved on cave walls or carved in various stone tablets, where a lot of the cultures, that when they were writing about what was going on, they were writing about food. They weren't writing about some self-actualized, person. They weren't writing about how someone's self-esteem is, this person's self-esteem was so great, and the whole culture was designed around, becoming more self-actualized. They were writing about food because it was the most important thing. That was what drove cultures, food. Okay, and you can see that in some of the early paintings on the cave walls and such, hunting buffalo and so forth. For our chronological and extremely hungry man, utopia can be defined very simply as a place where there is plenty of food. He tends to think that if only he is guaranteed food for the rest of his life, he will be perfectly happy and will never want anything more. Life itself tends to be defined in terms of eating. Anything else will be defined as unimportant. Freedom, love, community feeling, respect, philosophy may all be waved aside as fripperies, which are useless since they have failed to fill his stomach. Meaning, it doesn't mean a lick of sense. It won't make any difference to your employee if you tell him, I'm going to give you this prize for being the number one, salesman, or the number one, whatever the case is. If his needs for food have not been met, his physiological needs have not been met, it doesn't make a lick of difference how many rewards you want to throw at him. That's not going to be what motivates him to be a better person, be a better employee. What's going to motivate him is food. Okay? It's basically that simple. We continue. The next need, which is the safety need, the next, now we're going up the hierarchy. If the physiological needs are relatively well gratified, there then emerges a new set of needs, which we may categorize roughly as the safety needs. Now, these are things like you need a house. You need to be able to feel like you're secure in your home, that you're not afraid of the dark, or all these the various things. Now, Dr. Maslow goes into a rather lengthy analogy between safety needs and using adolescents and children as a means to explain this a little bit more easily. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail on that, because basically what he talks about is children are not born, or they're born and they feel secure when you hold them, right? and they have the safety need met when mom and dad holds them close. And that need to be safe is there. If you suddenly drop them, or you suddenly act like you're going to fall, they move. They shape because they felt safety, and now they didn't feel safety. And he goes into a lengthy explanation on that. Although in this paper we are interested primarily in the needs of the adult, we can approach an understanding of his safety needs perhaps more efficiently by observing the observations of infants and children in whom these needs are much, much more simple and obvious. And he goes into this whole rather lengthy explanation. I'm not going to go into that, but you can feel free to read it. By the way, this is available for free online. From these and similar observations of infants and children, we may generalize and say that the average child in our society generally prefers a safe, orderly, predictable, organized world which he can count on, and in which unexpected, unimaginable, or other dangerous things do not happen, and in which, in any case, he has an all-powerful parent who protects and shields him from harm. So children's the need to feel safe are satisfied by their parents, usually, and obviously assuming there's a normal upbringing. The healthy, normal, fortunate adult in our culture is largely satisfied in his safety needs. The peaceful, smoothly running, good society of ordinarily makes its members feel safe enough for wild animals, extremes of temperatures, criminals, assaults and murder, tyranny. Therefore, in a very real sense, he no longer has any safety needs as active motivators. So what they're saying is, we don't have to worry about the tribe across the river coming over and killing our infants and killing us in our sleep. We don't have to worry about that so much anymore. Okay. Well, unless, you know, Putin decides to act up more. But those sorts of fears of, say, you know, another country coming and invading the United States are essentially non-existent. They were existent to my grandfather. He flew 21 missions in World War II. There was a very real possibility that Nazi Germany could have taken over, and they didn't. But that was a serious fear back then. I mean, you know, there was a fear of safety. Okay. We don't really have that much anymore. Okay. So most people have a house. Most people have a place to live. Most people have a safety of not having to worry about, you know, being attacked in their sleep. Now I'm going to have an article in a couple of weeks that talks about migrant farm workers are coming here who don't have the same level of safety as we do. And there is some psychological concern there in that population. We continue. The neurosis in which the search for safety takes its dearest form is in the compulsive obsessive neurosis. Compulsive obsessives try frantically to order and stabilize the world so that no unimaginable, unexpected, or unfamiliar dangers will ever happen. They hedge themselves about with all sorts of ceremonies, rules, and formulas so that every possible contingency may be provided for, and so that no new contingencies may appear. And the reason I highlighted that is because if you're working with somebody, or you or your mother or your child or whatever is behaving in a certain way, in this case, he's using obsessive compulsive disorder. If they're behaving that way, and you have an employee who's behaving that way and they have this condition, reading this or understanding more about it, for me, helps me empathize with that person rather than look at them in a curious way. Look at them, well, what's going on? This guy's strange. What, he's flipping the light switch on 3 or 4 times and he's washing his hands 10 times an hour or whatever the case is. What's going on? I'd be apathetic to some degree, but now understanding this and reading this, and you can read more about this particular condition if you want, it helps me understand, oh, he has a condition. This is why he's doing it. I understand why he's doing it. Okay. If you got to do that to feel safe and that helps you, no problem. What can I do to help? Those are the sorts of behaviors and empathetic positions that I've learned to hold since I've gained more knowledge in this area. Okay. Now we go to the next one. The love needs. Now this is the third level. If both physiological and the safety needs are fairly well gratified, then there will emerge the love and affection and belongings needs, and the whole cycle already described will repeat itself with this new center. Now the person will feel keenly as never before the absence of friends or a sweetheart or a wife or children. He will hunger for affectionate relations with people in general, namely for a place in his group. And he will strive with great intensity to achieve this goal. He will want to attain such a place more than anything else in the world, and may even forget that once he was hungry, He sneered when he was hungry. He sneered at love. Okay. In other words, there's a need once your physiological needs are met, once your safety needs are met, there's a need to be a part of some things. Usually, again, it could be a part of your relationship, part of the church, part of a marriage, whatever the case is. And that's what he's talking about here. Love and affection, as well as their possible expressions in sexuality, are generally looked upon with ambivalence and are customarily hedged about with many restrictions and inhibitions. Now, this was in the 1940s, where sexuality and love was oppressed. Okay, women didn't even have the right to vote. When did they get the right to vote? I don't even remember. Sorry, I should know that. I mean, you know, the openness of sexuality that exists today was nowhere remotely open back then. You didn't talk about it. And what he's saying is it was oppressed. It was held down back then. And there's a basic need for reproduction. And there is a basic need in humans for affection and for love. And there's nothing embarrassing at all. We shouldn't have any second thoughts about expressing that and talking about it. Although that's one reason why I've been in therapy for years. That's probably this is my weakest part right here, the love needs. My wife's listening, so she can back me up on that. I don't want to go too far down that road, but this is one shortcoming that I have for sure. One thing that must be stressed at this point is that love is not synonymous with sex. Sex may be studied as a purely physiological need, which is where it belongs. Intercourse or reproduction is the basic physiological need. Ordinarily, sexual behavior is multi-determined, that is to say, determined not only by sexual, but also by other needs, chief among which are the love and affection needs. Also not to be overlooked is the fact that the love needs involve both giving and receiving love. Okay, so that's the third level. So now we're getting up to the esteem and the self-actualization level, and this is where I think many of us and many of our employees can benefit, particularly from the esteem section, from the self-esteem section, but also from self-actualization. If you're a business owner, if you've been around for 10, 20 years, and you've been down those roads many, many times, and you're not motivated necessarily by getting, 20 homes a day, 20 lawns a day done and doing all these, business, you're more interested in, what can my business do to better my community? How can I, how can I reach my potential, and how can my company reach its potential in terms of its value to society? Well, that's where esteem and the self-actualization comes in. The esteem needs. All people in our society, with a few pathological exceptions, have a need or desire for a stable, firmly based, high evaluation of themselves, for self-respect or self-esteem, and for the self-esteem of others. By firmly based self-esteem, we mean that which is soundly based upon real capacity, achievement, and respect from others. These needs may be classified into two subsidiary sets. These are, first, the desire for strength, for achievement, for adequacy, for confidence in the face of the world, and for independence and freedom. I'm going to come back to this paragraph. Secondly, we have what we may call the desire for reputation or prestige, defining it as a respect or esteem from other people, recognition, attention, importance, or appreciation. Now, I'm going to talk about this a little bit here. I'll try to do this as professional as I can. The self-esteem needs are where I have, in the past, failed to understand how people behaved, and it really got to me a lot. I didn't understand why they were doing certain things, and now looking back, I'm like, oh, if I'd known this back then, it would have really helped my own mental well-being, my own, mental health. Back then, if I had known it, it would have, lowered the temperature a lot. So, I want to give you a couple examples. I'll just leave the names out of it. So years ago, I used to work for a company that had a group of sales managers, and the sales managers would meet on the phone once a month or once every 2 months. And above them was the vice president of sales, I think is what his title was. I can't remember now. And we had a program, a sales program that we were developing, and the sales managers developed it along with the VP. So we all collectively say, hey, this is what we think we can do to help motivate the employees and to help gain more revenue and more, you know, margin and so forth. And we came up with this concept of this game that we were going to play, and we were going to do all these things and compete against other salesmen and so forth. And we spent some time developing it. And I'll kind of get to the point here quick. And the VP presented it at the national sales meeting. And when he presented it, he proceeded to say, I'm going to speak as if I was him. He says, I spent many months doing this and I developed this, and I want to thank all the people in the marketing department who helped me develop this. And I did this. He didn't give a lick of any accolades or thanks to the sales team, the sales managers who helped develop it. I mean, in other words, we developed it with his input for sure, but we developed it and we said, hey, we want to do this. And he said, sure. And he worked with us and we did it. But then when in front of all the owners, it was all about him. He did it. He didn't want there to be any perception that anybody else contributed to it. It was him. That sent me off to a degree I can't even begin to explain. Thinking about it now, my blood pressure is already going back up. After this meeting, I went out in the parking lot and I called my wife and I said, I'm leaving. I can't do this anymore. You know, it's too much. I can't do it. And while I was on the phone with her, another sales manager, now this is while the sales meeting is going on. People are still in the building. Okay. I'm in the parking lot in my truck. And I was like, I got to leave. I got to get out of here. You know, this is not going to work. And I hear this on the window. I'm like, whoa. And then somebody was knocking on my window in the parking lot. And it was another sales manager. And that sales manager came in he said, hey, can I talk to you? And I said, sure. And I said, he said, you know, what do you think? And blah, blah, blah. I won't go into the details. But he talked me off the cliff that night. And what helped me then, and looking back on it, what helps me now is I recognize now that the VP is operating in the self-esteem level of the hierarchy. He wanted everybody to think that he, you know, was it. He wanted all the respect. He wanted all the accolades. He wanted other people to see him as very knowledgeable and very, you know, productive, and he wanted the owners to think that he was the one doing it all. He needed that esteem. He needed that. And I didn't. What I wanted to do was I wanted to see what can we do to reach our most potential. I wanted to see what can we do to motivate the salesman to reach their potential. What can we do to get the company to reach its potential? I'm operating at the self-actualization level, and the VP is operating at the self-esteem level. I didn't realize that then. Looking back on it now, I'm like, oh, that's why he's doing it. Now, it doesn't make his actions right. It doesn't make them helpful. It was very harmful to his sales managers. And if he's listening, he knows exactly who I'm talking about. It was very harmful to your sales managers. And looking back on it, now I have the knowledge to go, if this was to happen to me again, still wouldn't sit well with me, but the temperature wouldn't go up so high with me. I go, you know what? This guy is operating at a self-esteem level. He needs the gratification. He needs everybody to look at him and say, hey, he's great. He did all this. Look how smart he is. You're fantastic. Pat him on the back. Great job. He needs all that. And I didn't. And I think that's why I got so hot and was so angry. I was just angry. I mean, it was not pretty. Okay. It was not a good evening. And, you know, since then, a couple of things have happened with other areas. And I recognize, oh, you know what? This person needs that. And so now, instead of getting upset, I try to find ways that I can help them meet that need to feel, you know, self-esteem, greater self-esteem than where they're at. So that's an example. His behavior is not condoned. I don't condone his behavior. But it helps me, my own mental health, my own well-being, it helps me come to terms with why he was behaving this way. He wasn't doing it with an intent of holding me down and you know, suppressing me. He wasn't doing that. He wasn't thinking about me at all. He's thinking about him. Okay. So in that way, it helped me and helps me now cope with certain similar situations. Okay. The next thing is, I'll have to come back to the chat. I can't keep up with the chat, guys. Sorry. The next thing it says here is, secondly, we have what we may call the desire for reputation or prestige. Okay. Recognition, attention, importance. Now, right now, you can go right now as we speak, and there's been someone in the turfgrass community who has made very critical comments about me. Now I'm old. I'm 48 years old. When all that stuff was happening years ago, I was, God, I don't even know, 30, I think it was 10 or 15 years ago, whatever, however old I was. Now, a similar thing's happening in the sense, not the similar thing in that exact way, but a similar behavior is occurring in someone else. And someone in the lawn care community is being critical of me, saying certain things about me that are not flattering to me or about me. And it gets me a little bit irritated. I'm like, well, why would he say that? But instead of my temperature going up like it used to, now I think, well, why is he saying that stuff? What's motivating him? And you can go on right now and read one of the forums where he's just outright lying, just completely lying about me. He's saying Travis believes in phosphorus and potassium starvation, which I've never said, I've never implied, and he knows it, and he's lying. And when I first read that, my first initial reaction is frustration and, you know, disappointment, a great deal of disappointment. But then now, being a little more mature, more knowledgeable on what motivates people and so forth, I sit and go, well, what's motivating this person to say these things? So now I'm thinking about why is he doing it, not what did he do and how, you know, whatever he's doing, acting, however he's acting. And so for me, that provides some solace, contemplating about why is this person behaving this way? And I'm convinced at this point that this person is behaving this way because he needs the self-esteem. He needs to feel like he's, you know, accepted by his peers as being knowledgeable and helpful and useful in this particular world. And in so doing, apparently he feels like he's going to build his self-esteem up by pushing me down or by attacking me in some way or whatever. And that may or may not be true, but that's the way I'm reading it. And that knowledge provides solace. It brings my temperature down, helps my mental health. Okay. Because believe me, 20 years ago, I wouldn't behave in this way. I wouldn't be acting this way. My friend Smoke Home will tell you that. Okay. Trust me. I was a totally different person, and I think I've grown and become a better person. And one way I've done that is to take things when instances come up and ask myself, why is this person doing that? And if I can identify it, even if it's wrong, even if their behavior is completely unwarranted and harmful, at least knowing why they're doing it helps me. Personally. And so think about yourself when I'm talking about this. Think about yourself. Are there other instances where Dr. Shattuck's saying these things where in my relationship with my employee or my relationship with my boss or my wife or my husband, are there any areas that he's talking about now that I can relate to what's going on in my life? Why did he quit? Why did this employee that I've had for 2 years, why did he quit? Why did he go and work for another company? What was motivating him to do that? Was he not getting the self-esteem? Were you not patting him on the back and saying good job? Were you not giving him the awards and you're not, you know, showcasing his talents in front of others? Maybe that's what would have motivated him. Maybe it was money. Okay, so think about that as we kind of go through here. Satisfaction of the self-esteem need leads to feelings of self-confidence, worth, strength, capability, and adequacy of being useful and necessary in the world. So this person who's saying these things, and in one case, just outright lying about me, I think maybe this person doesn't feel as self-confident as he would like. He doesn't feel adequate to the degree that he would like. And I think he thinks he'll get he's not necessarily cognizantly thinking this, but he may feel as if he's gaining more confidence by ridiculing or criticizing another person, right? These feelings in turn give rise to either basic discouragement or else compensatory or neurotic trends. Okay, so that sums up the self-esteem, and we're going to self-actualization, and then we're done. The need for self-actualization. Even if all of these needs are satisfied, we may still, all these needs being the hierarchy up to this point, the physiological needs, the safety needs, the, what was the other one? I always forgot. The love needs, and then the self-esteem needs. If all those are met, we may still often expect that a new discontent and restlessness will soon develop unless the individual is doing what he is fit for. A musician must make music. An artist must paint. A poet must write if he is to be ultimately happy. And I agree. I'm going to do what I'm doing, whether I'm getting paid or not. It doesn't matter. Okay. It's just the way it is. I'm wired this way. I'm going to be doing research for the rest of my life. That's just what motivates me. I enjoy it. I think to me personally, I think there's voids in the research that are not going to be filled until someone comes along and someone answers it. In other words, I don't think the potential for the scientific model that we're trying to build is ever going to be met. I'm trying to contribute to the potential that we can reach by doing these things. That's just what motivates me. And I agree. Poets have to write. You're going to do it one way or the other. Scientists are going to do science. If you're motivated on the self-actualization level, you're going to do science one way or the other. What a man can be, he must be. This need we may call self-actualization. So if you can be that, you must be that. If you can do it, if you can reach that potential, that's what you're trying to strive for. That's self-actualization. This term, first coined by Kurt Goldstein, is being used in this paper in a much more specific and limited fashion. It refers to the desire for self-fulfillment, namely, to the tendency for him to become self-actualized in what he is potentially. This tendency might be phrased as the desire to become more and more what one is, to become everything that one is capable of becoming. And the last session, I've had 9 or 10 therapists over the years, and as I move, or they move, or whatever the case is, you have to find another one. And the last time I started one, I just came to, you know, I've started, it takes a while. It takes a couple of months to feel comfortable with the therapist. I mean, it's maybe a year. It takes a long time. But I try to just skip ahead now because I've done this so many times. And I say, okay, well, you know, why are you here? What do you want to talk about? And I tell them, I just want to be a better person. I'm not content with where I'm at. I want to be a better human. I want to be a better father. I want to be a better husband. I just want to be better at who I am. And I don't think I can get there on my own. And I want to find weaknesses in myself and my personality, and I want to figure out how I can work on those weaknesses and still maintain my strengths. And they're like, okay. So I just cut to the point because that's what I want. That's what I want. I want to be a better person. That's what they're talking about here. How can you reach your potential? The clear emergence of these needs rests upon prior satisfaction of the physiological, safety, love, and esteem needs. We shall call people who are satisfied in these needs basically satisfied people. And it is from these that we may expect the fullest and healthiest creativeness. Since in our society, basically satisfied people are the exception, we do not know much about self-actualized, either experimentally or clinically. So at the time, in 43, they didn't know about many, many people in this category. Okay, they didn't know. These are people like, you know, you can make an argument like Abraham Lincoln or Albert Einstein or Muhammad or Jesus or the Buddha, or, I mean, there's a lot of people you can put on the self-actualized level. The Dalai Lama now obviously is a very good example of self-actualized human. There's people, and you don't have to be at that level. I mean, in terms of like notoriety to be self-actualized. You just need to have the major motivating factor in your mind being, how do I become the best person that I can be, you know, in whatever world that is. It could be your business. How can I create my business or move my business forward such that it reaches its greatest potential? That would be your business functioning at a self-actualized level. The precondition for the basic need satisfaction. Oh yeah, this is important. Yeah. Okay. Hang on. Let me get this right here. I don't know why this thing continues to mess up. Okay. Okay. Still not there. Okay. The precondition for the basic need satisfactions. Okay. There are certain conditions which are immediate prerequisites for the basic need satisfactions. Danger to these is reacted to almost as if it were a direct danger to the basic needs needs themselves. Such conditions as freedom to speak, freedom to do what one wishes so long as no harm is done to others, freedom to express oneself, freedom to investigate and seek for more information, freedom to defend oneself, justice, fairness, honesty, orderliness in the group are examples of such preconditions for basic need satisfaction. Thwarting in these freedoms will be reacted to with a threat or emergency response. In other words, if you come and tell someone in the United States you no longer have a freedom of speech, there's going to be some serious reaction. Okay, I'm telling you. I mean, and I'm one of them. The Bill of Rights was written for a reason. The Magna Carta was one of the most important documents ever written. Okay, the Bill of Rights and our Constitution is one of the most the most important documents ever written. So the point is, there's some basic needs that are that flow along with the hierarchy needs. And those are things like we have a need to be able to, you know, have a freedom of religion or have no religion, have be able to stand on the corner in a public spot and have a freedom of speech, be able to say certain things. Okay, we have that need, and that fits in here with the, these are preconditions for the basic needs. Okay, they flow along with them. These These conditions are not ends in themselves, but they are almost so since they are so closely related to the basic needs, which are apparently the only ends in themselves. These conditions are defended because without them, the basic satisfactions are quite impossible, or at least very severely endangered. In other words, we don't have the freedom to bear arms. You don't have the freedom of speech. You don't have the freedom of religion. You don't have these basic freedoms or whatever. Imagine if you didn't. Imagine going back, 500 years, and you're oppressed by theocracies, and you can't get basic food, get basic water. You can't get basic housing because the theocratic governments are in control of what you do, and you have to follow their rules based upon their holy book. Imagine. Difficult. So these preconditions are imperative to understand. If we remember that the cognitive capacities, perceptual intellectual learning, are a set of adjustment tools which have, among other functions, that of satisfaction of our basic needs, then it is clear that any danger to them, any deprivation or blocking of their free use, must also be indirectly threatening to the basic needs themselves. Such a statement is a partial solution of the general problems of curiosity, the search of knowledge, truth, wisdom, and ever-persistent urge to solve the cosmic mysteries. Now, think about Galileo. He had a need to pursue science, pursue knowledge. He had a need to pursue the unknown, and he was arrested in the house. He was put in prison. Well, not in prison. Technically, he was in prison, but he was in house arrest by the church. Okay. He was oppressed. Imagine that today. Imagine if you were looking at the sun and you're saying, oh, the sun is not rotating around the earth. The earth is rotating around the sun. And the religious theocracies of those times put you in prison for that. Imagine how that's going to thwart your basic needs. That's what he's talking about here. The desire to know and to understand. So far, we have mentioned the cognitive needs only in passing. Acquiring knowledge and systemizing the universe have been considered as, in part, techniques for achievements of basic safety in the world, or for the intelligent man, expressions of self-actualization. Okay, here's another one here. Yeah, this is about Galileo. I connected this to Galileo. Curiosity, exploration, desire for the facts, desire to know may certainly be observed easily enough. The fact that they are often are pursued, even at great cost to the individual safety, is an earnest of the partial character of our previous discussion. Galileo knew what he was saying. I mean, when he went to court, he denied it a little bit, but eventually they got it out of him. And he said, yeah, no, the earth is moving. The sun's not. Okay. And that's the reason he got put in. Even he knew he was going to get put in prison. And technically, he didn't get in prison. He got in house arrest, but they commuted that to house arrest after he was in prison. But he knew that, and he still, all he had to do was say, no. But he still said, no, the earth's moving. The earth is moving, okay? So he had a need, and it was so strong that even the threat of imprisonment didn't do away, it didn't keep him from satisfying that need. He had to say, the earth is moving. Okay, that's basically what it comes down to in that particular sentence. We're coming down to the very end, guys. Once these desires are accepted for discussion, we see that two forms themselves into a small hierarchy in which the desire to know is prepotent over the desire to understand. We must guard ourselves against the too easy tendency to separate these desires from the basic needs we have discussed above, i.e. to make a sharp dichotomy between cognitive and connotative needs. The desire to know and to understand are themselves connotative, i.e. having a striving character, and are as much personality needs as the basic needs we have already discussed. Now, let me see here. This is actually, I may have to come back to this on another day or something. There's a lot more left here. Let me see if I can get to it. I'm just going to start reading. See if I can get through this. There's a lot left. Further characterization of the basic needs. The degree of fixity of the hierarchy of the basic needs. We have spoken so far as if the hierarchy were a fixed order, but actually it is not nearly as rigid as we may have implied. It is true that most of the people with whom we have worked have seemed to have these basic needs in about the order that has been indicated. However, there have been a number of exceptions. And what he basically does, I'll just summarize it. What he basically does, he goes into several exceptions, and he's saying that some people who are operating at, say, 80 or 90% of the physiological needs might then have 5 or 10% of their interest in the level above and so forth. So it's not like you have to be 100% satisfied of your physiological needs before you go into the safety needs, you know, and so before you go into love and acceptance needs and so forth. There can be some percentages below which are not 100% before you continue to move up, and your motivation is dictated by a higher level of your higher of the hierarchy. Okay. So this, I want to read this one. So the, I'm not going to read this whole thing because it's already 10:15. So in certain people, the level of aspiration may be permanently deadened or lowered. That is to say, the less prepotent goals may simply be lost and may disappear forever. So that the person who has experienced life at a very low level, chronic unemployment, may continue to be satisfied for the rest of their life if only he can get enough food. So what he's saying is that if you're used to not having no food, or you're used to striving for food and constantly trying to struggle for food, that may be all that you need to be satisfied. Even if you do have higher levels and you've achieved great things, you grew up in an environment that was poor, and you are so accustomed to striving to get food and striving to get water, and that was constantly on your mind all the time. And now, say you're an executive, you may divert back in some cases to, like, I just want food, even though you're a very successful person, right? So there can be exceptions to the rules and exceptions to the manner in which you move up the hierarchy. I'm not going to read into all this other stuff, but you're welcome to read it into yourself. And I'm just going to skip through this, actually, because there's some really important things, but it's going to be another hour and I don't want to do that. I'm not going to read that either. Yeah, it's just what I said about the 100% thing. Multiple motivations of behavior. The clinical psychologists have long since found that any behavior may be a channel through which flow various determinants, or to say it in another way, most behavior is multi-motivated. Within the sphere of motivational determinants, any behavior tends to be determined by several or all of the basic needs simultaneously rather than one or the other. So the reason I say that is because it is easy to say, okay, this employee is motivated by money. This employee is motivated by self-esteem, whatever. But oftentimes it's a number of things, not just one thing or the other. But think of it as categories. It can kind of help direct you to what motivates them. And when I was in South Florida working in Miami, there was, I worked in sports turf, and my employees were hourly workers, and they mowed and they did all the basic needs of the turf. And whenever I asked them, well, what can I do for you? And what can we do to help motivate you guys and bonuses or whatever? All they wanted was money. That's it. Just give us more money. They would leave. They could work for you for 2 years and they would leave you for a nickel an hour and go work for an employee, for a competitor. And then they'd come back 3 months later for another nickel an hour if you gave them another nickel an hour. That's what motivated them. When you go into sales and you're dealing with professionals at a very high level, and well, some of them are motivated by money, but oftentimes they've been doing it for so many years. When I would ask them what motivates them, what can I do to help you? It wasn't give me more money. It were things like, how can you make my job easier? You know, how can you reduce some of the paperwork or reduce some of the hoops? Or basically they wanted to know, I just want to do my job the best I can do it. The best I can do it oftentimes is limited by the amount of red tape and the amount of, you know, computer work I got to do. I would rather go out and just, you know, sell and be with customers. In other words, they're looking to reach their potential and they're asking me, what can you, you know, I say, what can I do to help you? They're not saying I need to reach my potential, but that's what they're saying back to me is like, what can you do to minimize some of this other red tape and paperwork so that I can reach my potential? That's what they're saying. So they're in turn, they're going to make more money, but they're not motivated by me giving them another quarter an hour, giving them another whatever percentage. I mean, they're going to take it. Believe me, no salesman's going to turn it down, but that's not really what's driving them. So think about yourself and your own business. What is motivating your employees? Think about what level they're on and then try to work with them within that level. There's no sense trying to reduce paperwork for a person who doesn't have a house. When they leave, they're living in their car. And they're worried, they're motivated by the safety needs first, right? I really wish I could read this whole thing, but it's just too long. Let me get down here to some of the red things. And it's still just too long. 10:20. Maybe I'll come back to this later in the month, but because there's still so much more. But that I think you can get the gist of it. Okay. The gist of it is there is a logic to trying to determine, why is this person behaving this way? Where do they fit on the hierarchy of needs? I have an employee who I want to reach his or her greatest potential so that my company can reach its greatest potential. What can I do to help motivate this person? For me, what has helped me the most has first been to try to identify where they are on that level, on the hierarchy. Where are they? Because if they want self-esteem, I'm going to try to tailor things to self-esteem. Okay. I had a salesman who I was trying to figure out what was going on. How can I help you? And I was, you know, trying to, what can I do? Sales programs or this or that. He couldn't have cared less about any of that. He didn't care less about money. He didn't care less about marketing and helping him come around and see customers. And he couldn't care less about any of that stuff. What he was motivated by was self-actualization. He was operating at a very high level. He wanted to know, how can I be the best, not just salesman, but the best employee, the best person? And that meant he and I would go to conferences. He and I were going to leadership conferences. How can he be the best leader that he can be? And then once I recognized that, he and I started going to leadership conferences together, which I was already going to. I didn't know he wanted to go. So I said, come on, let's go. And he and I would go to leadership conferences. And he just changed and blossomed. And now he's a very, very successful person in the industry. And you could just see in his face and his behavior and the way he walked, it just changed because I recognized finally, oh, that's what's motivating him. Let's get him on that level. Let's get him on. And he jumped on board and it just took off. So those are some anecdotes in my own personal experience of how understanding these basic hierarchy of needs helped me in my career and my business and me as a person help with my mental health and kind of help keep the temperature down when I need to. Because sometimes I still get a little hot. Let's go to the chat before I go. And there's so much chat, I'm going to have to be quick. I don't even know where to start. Eric Lickness says, check out EDICI Rick Ryan for self-determination theory. They are here at the uni where I work. Okay. Yeah, sorry, I just can't keep up with all the chat. I'm really glad there's a lot of chat, but Eric Lisa says, I've seen more than once a high-tech project manager say his job was to give people credit for the work they do. First time I heard that, but hearing the VP story now, I know why. One of my jobs in my own mind, after going to years of leadership conferences, was in some ways I wanted to develop in the salesman the skills necessary so that they wouldn't need me. I wanted to develop their potential and their knowledge and their skills to the point where they didn't need to call me for really anything. They could operate it on their own. That's the way I operated. And but unfortunately, that's not the way my superiors operated. So it didn't work out for me. But I felt like that was a good approach. And regardless of what happened to me, I do think that the salesmen that I worked with back then, I do think they're better off for it. Six Sigma, all is well for me for sure. Appreciate your kind words, Eric Lickness. Thanks. Western Mass, welcome. And I think that's it. Okay, guys, I have a song that I can virtually guarantee you no one's ever heard. There's almost no chance you've ever heard it. So if you like guitar music, you'll like this. It was put out by an artist who this song was put out in 2015. This artist in 2015 put out 118 albums. That's right. It's like one album every 2.5 days or 3 days for the entire year of 2015. And this song was on one of his albums in 2015, which I like. And so I'm going to play it as I go. I really appreciate everybody showing up. Thanks. I'll see you guys, the members, at least on Monday morning. Have a great one. Appreciate it. And now, Turf Thoughts by Ken Corley. One of my fondest childhood memories was working on the farm with Grandpa Alfred. One morning, when we were preparing to spray the alfalfa, I asked Grandpa Alfred, "Why do you use that wooden spoon to mix the pesticide tank?" Grandpa replied, "Because I can't reach the bottom of the tank with just my hand." That made a lot of sense to me. Grandpa was a wise old man. He died of cancer 2 years later. At his funeral, I thought, I don't think that spoon was long enough.